I don't buy every conspiracy theory out there. In fact, you might say I'm a curious skeptic. But there is just enough evidence to consider the possibility that the powers that be are manipulating us like so many pawns on a chessboard. That's why we hear the theories out on Jim Harold's Conspiracy Corner. Welcome to Conspiracy Corner. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. Now, if you've listened to these programs for any time at all, you probably know that we've done more shows on the JFK assassination than any other possible conspiracy out there. And one reason is because I'm utterly fascinated by it. I think there's a lot more to it than the public was led to believe. And secondly, I can't think of something in the 20th century other than the Second World War that had a greater long-term impact on the United States in many different ways. So I think it's important to look back, and if we can bring new information to the fore, we obviously want to help do that. And today we're going to bring some interesting information to the fore, because I think most of you who have followed the literature on the JFK assassination are very familiar with the Zapruder film. Very famous. When it was shown to the American public for the first time in the 1970s on the Geraldo Rivera program, I think it was Good Night America or something like that on ABC.
Yeah,
it really was. It was stunning. And but there's another film, and we have a great guest. You just heard her voice to talk about it because her grandfather shot the film. She's just come out with a new book. I'm talking about Gail Nix Jackson. The book is The Missing JFK Assassination Film, The Mystery Surrounding the Orville Nix Home Movie of November 22nd, 1963. And Gail Nix Jackson is the granddaughter of Orville Nix, and she holds a master's in English and rhetoric from Texas Woman's University. She is a former English professor, happy mother, and sometimes patient wife and daughter. Her greatest dreams include finding the Nix film, and she currently resides in Texas. And she says, I love in her bio, she says she knows more about baseball than cleaning house. So That's great. I love that.
It's true.
I love that. Well, Gail, welcome to the program today.
Thank you so much.
Can you give us a brief overview of what the Nix film is? I'm suspecting that there are people who have been interested in the JFK assassination for as long as they can remember. Maybe even some people who actually remember the event, but have never heard of the Nix film. What is the Nix film?
The Nix film is taken from the other side of the Zapruder film. And honestly, the movie probably, well, it doesn't exist. The only copies do now, and I'll get to that in a moment. But my grandfather did not even realize he was taking the movie. Was there, he brought me, my mom, and my grandmother down because he wanted us to see the president. We were supposed to meet him at Main Street. And there were so many people, so many crowds, we couldn't get there to meet him. So when the motorcade came, as it was turning from Main onto Houston, he started filming. And he realized that Ralph Yarbrough, who was a senator in Texas at the time, waved at him. He didn't much care for Mr. Yarbrough. So he ran across the median. And how do I say that? It's not really the median. There's a grassy part between Main Street and Elm. And he ran along the Main Street side of the grassy part and was taking pictures. And then that's when the gunfire started. And he was essentially white knuckling. He had a Keystone camera and it had a grip on it like a gun. And he was essentially white knuckling it and taking the picture. And when you see the picture, it looks like the motorcade, the Queen Mary, is going uphill, which, I mean, goes to show where he was holding the camera and why he really didn't have it in focus. But it shows the grassy knoll in its entirety. Not only does he take the film and show the motorcade speeding off to Parkland, but then he pans back around. So not only do you see Zapruder in my grandfather's film, but you see the headshot, and it is horrific. It's not as graphic as the Zapruder film because he was standing so much further back. But you do see the grassy knoll. You see the stockade fence, as he called it, which we know as the picket fence. And it is the only extant film that shows the grassy knoll in its entirety. Now, the film is missing. the original film. And you say, yeah, Gil, what does it matter? There's copies of it everywhere. You can look on YouTube. I mean, my uncle's grandfather's wife, nephew has a copy of it. Well, that's true. That's true. There are copies everywhere, but there's not an original film. And with today's technology, if we had that original film, we could have it analyzed. And you know what? We might find that there was another shooter there. And you know what else? We might find that there wasn't. But wouldn't it be nice to find the next film and put an end to that big question? Because there are so many revolving around the JFK assassination. We could put an end to that one by finding the next film, but it's gone. And so how does it go? I have been able to track it back as far as the House Select Committee. And after that, it's nowhere to be found. And Robert Blakey has told me over and over and over, Gail, if we find that it came up missing, I take full responsibility. And that's where we are. And that's what the book is written about, how the film came about, how it affected my grandfather, how it came up missing. That's what the book is about.
And for those who aren't familiar, the name Blakey is familiar. Explain to people who Blakey is.
Yeah. He was the head of the House Select Committee, the lawyer. He's still alive. He was the lawyer. In fact, he wrote a book later after the House Select Committee saying that he felt the mafia was responsible. And so he believed that there was a conspiracy as well. It is hard for me to understand how people in today's times, and especially after living in the last 50 years, how we've lived with things that happen in the government, knowing that we're not always told the truth about things, how people could not believe that there wasn't a conspiracy here. And even if you don't believe that there was another shooter with Lee Harvey Oswald, or if Lee Harvey Oswald even took a shot, what you must believe is that we were lied to, because we were. We were lied to. And it is important to not only hold people and our government responsible for the things they do, but to tell us the truth. I mean, how are we ever going to heal from this? I mean, as you said in the beginning, the death of the president and this murder in downtown Dallas is a key event in American history. And it still affects those who were living now, those who were living then and are still alive. And the way that we have conducted ourselves, the way that we view the media, the way that we view government, it affected all those things. And we need to put a resolution and come to terms with it all. And we can't do that if we don't have all the evidence. And we don't. And the next film is one of them.
Now, in terms of your grandfather, tell us a little bit about the events of that day. Obviously, the assassination happened. He took and you told us a little bit about how he was white knuckling and he had this camera. And people have to remember the cameras back then were nothing like the cameras today. Nothing. But the point is that, okay, he takes the film. What happens after he takes the film and witnesses this horrible event?
Okay, well, he is immediately, and I guess I should back up. He worked for the General Services Administration, which was a branch of the government. Essentially, they're the ones that took care of the air conditioning, the heating, the machinery, that's who he worked for. And he, at that time, had been transferred to the Terminal Annex building, which is the big building. Harry Holmes, who was the postal inspector, who was one of the last few to talk to Oswald, he worked there. J.C. Price was my grandfather's boss. He worked there. In fact, he was on the roof with binoculars watching the whole presidential assassination, watching the whole motorcade. But anyway, my grandfather had gone down there and he had bought this camera for the express purpose of watching and seeing the motorcade for his grandkids. He was a very loving grandfather. He truly was. And he used the wrong film that day because he was still a newbie at understanding the photography and what kind of film to be using. And like I said earlier, we were supposed to have met him down there so we could all watch together, because Forrest Sorrells, who was the FBI agent, if people who are aware of the Kennedy assassination would know Forrest Sorrells because he was the head FBI agent. I'm sorry. Yeah, they had an agent down in Dallas that was over everything, not FBI, the Secret Service, that was over everything. He was my grandfather's friend, and they played golf together at Cedar Crest Country Club and played. And he's the one that told my grandfather where to stand that day. He said, you know what, if you're taking your kids, this would be a good place. And he had told him like a week before that this is where to go. So after my grandfather took the film, he wasn't really sure that he had assassination footage at all. So, I mean, he knew that he had the part where Ralph Yarbrough waving at him, where the president and the first lady had turned from Main onto Houston Street, but he didn't know. So he looked down at his viewfinder and he said, I've still got plenty of film left. I mean, because, you know, those old timing cameras, they would let you know how much film footage you still had.
Right.
So he looked down and he said, oh, I've got plenty of film. I must not have gotten it. So he didn't think another thing of it. He was more concerned as to where we were. So he went back up Main Street. We were supposed to meet at the H.O. Green's department store. If we didn't meet that day, that was the backup plan. So he came and found us there to make sure we were all okay, because the whole of Dallas was just in shock. And everyone was scared. And worried about, you think about terrorism today. I mean, that's what it was like in downtown Dallas.
You've got people firing. Yeah. You got people firing live rounds. You're in the middle of the Cold War.
Oh,
you think,
yes.
Could this be the part of some kind of attack on the United States? I mean, you have to remember.
And here we are in the middle of the Cold War.
And only 22 years removed from Pearl Harbor, and many people did remember Pearl Harbor. So I think I'm guessing just as if when we have a terrorist attack today, I think everybody's mind goes back to 9/11. I think back then when things happened, dramatic things, people would say, "Remember Pearl Harbor." So people were leery.
Right. And so here he sees people dive bombing into the ground, hiding from bullets, and he didn't know if he was going to get shot or what. I mean, it was quite traumatic, not only for him, for everyone that was down there that day. So he found us and he was okay. He thought he didn't have any footage. Now, this is November 22nd. So he goes about the next morning. He takes my grandmother downtown to show her where he was standing and what he saw, because, I mean, it was all the talk. It was on TV. There was nothing else on television except this. I mean, 24 hours a day for 3 days, 4 days straight. I mean, as little kids, we couldn't watch cartoons because, you know, there was news footage going on. So he went down to show my grandmother, and you can see that on his film, too, that he came back and you know, took that footage. He still looked down in his viewfinder and had plenty of film left. Well, the next weekend, they had canceled all of the football games. Well, most of the football games that weekend, of course, due out of reverence to the president's death. And everybody was just so torn up. So the next weekend, my dad had said, Dad, would you go down to the South Oak Cliff football game? Elaine, who was my mother, her brother's girlfriend is performing, and do you still have any film left in your camera? He goes, yeah, I do, and I need to use it up. My grandmother would get on to my grandfather all the time about how much money he blew on film. I mean, because she worked for Wyatt's Cafeteria. She worked in the cafeteria. He was a janitor for the GSA. It's not like they were rich or wealthy or had any money. Yeah, you know, I mean, they didn't. They were watching their every dime. And so he said, yeah, I've got to get rid of the rest of this film. I'll do that. So that next, it was a Saturday night, because they had doubled up football games on Fridays and Saturdays. And in Texas, football is what it's all about. So he went down on Saturday night, took the rest of the footage. When it was all gone, he dropped it off at Dynacolor, which was it was one of many developing labs in the area. It was a Kodak one, which was where they took the Zapruder film, but my grandfather took his Dynacolor, which was a bit of a discount type developing company, I suppose you would say, you know? So he took it down there, dropped it off, came home, watched television, and fell asleep watching television the next weekend until he got a phone call in the middle of the night. And it was the men at Dynacolor who said, Mr. Nix, we have been issued an edict from the FBI that we are supposed to turn in every bit of film footage that we have of the assassination. And I don't know how we overlooked yours. See, I suppose they thought that he had turned it in the weekend before, because it had been a week since the assassination, you know? And my grandfather said, well, I just turned it in tonight. And he said, oh, well, then you need to come down here and look at it, because we have to give it to the FBI. Okay, so my grandfather calls up my dad. And I have to remember, my dad was all of 23 or 24 at that time, and said, son, go downtown with me. We need to go. They've got film footage, and they say I've got the assassination on there. So my dad and my grandfather went down in the middle of the night to Dynacolor, which was in downtown Dallas. And sure enough, they put it up on a white wall. They projected. They didn't have a screen. They did have a projector. And so they just projected it on a white wall, and they watched it over and over and over. And till finally, the man at Dynacolor said, Mr. Nix, you know, we better stop watching it, because I'm scared the light bulb is going to burn the film. Because, right, you know, the projectors during that time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, it's funny, because I was just on the and that was a little more, but I was a little kid in the 70s, and my dad had a next generation, but it was a Super 8. And the thing is, I remember those films were very brittle, and everything was very tenuous. You know, it could break.
Yes.
And if you imagine this, you have one of the only films of the assassin. You have the actual copy of that, and you're playing it, the fear that if it breaks at an inopportune point,
that has
to be spliced. Yeah. That information is gone.
Yes, that's it. That's right. So my grandfather said, okay, and they said, we need to take it to the FBI. And he goes, no. I know where the FBI is. I used to work in that building. I will take it. So he came home, and he called Forest Worlds. Now, by this time, it's like 6 or 7 in the morning. And it's on a Sunday. And he called Forrest Rolls, and Forrest said, you know, take it down to the guys on Santa Fe and tell them I said take it. And he did. He took the film down there. Well, FBI kept it for 3 days. Well, actually 4. And after they told him that, you know, they only needed it for a day, they were just going to make a copy. And he never understood why they kept it for so long. And I will tell you now, this is my grandfather. This is what he told us till the day he died, that he said that when the film came back, it wasn't the same. But you must remember, I mean, he had watched it on a wall, you know, what, 30 or 40 times. That's all he'd seen it. And I mean, I don't know. I was always very, like, the bratty grandkid. I was like, well, Papa, how do you know? I mean, you only watched it on the wall. I mean, maybe you didn't see, maybe it looks different on a screen than it does on a wall. And he would say, I know what I saw. I know that it's jumpy here, and it wasn't jumpy when I watched it on the wall. So anyway, the government kept it. The FBI kept it for several days, and he felt that it was changed when he got it back. During that time, I suppose that the FBI had let the people at Time Life and the media know that the film was available. And the next thing he knew, Time Life had called and said, well, we want to see your film. Because I suppose at that point, Time Life was trying to grab every assassination film they could to have it within their grasp. And so my grandfather thought, well, I mean, and by that time, news had already gotten out about how much money Zapruder had been paid. And here's my grandfather with a fourth grade education and my grandmother working on the cafeteria line at Wyatt's. And he's thinking, wow, I might can sell it for at least half of what Zapruder got. And since it's from the other side, and there's my retirement money. I mean, he really thought that that's what it was going to be. So Time Life sent him a ticket, and he and my dad flew to New York, and they went down there, and it was a bad, bad meeting. And when he walked up to Time Life, the man who took him up to meet Art Keeler and Mr. Chapin was James Wagonboard. And I don't know if you know him, but he, when I was writing this book, was very serendipitous. He called me because he had heard that I was writing this book. And he didn't, and he said, I'm the man who introduced your dad and your grandfather to the Time Life executives. And since then, I mean, we have had we're dear friends. I mean, he's a wonderful, wonderful man. But anyway, so he introduced them. Time Life watches it over and over and over. And they finally get together in their little crowd of suited men and talk. And then they come to my grandfather and they say, okay, we don't view this as anything but a nuisance film, and we'll give you $3,000 for it. Well, my grandfather was quite upset. He thought, you know, first off, that it wasn't a nuisance film, that it's the assassination footage, but because it's not as graphic, I suppose, as a Zapruder film, and it's from the other angle, they didn't think that, you know, it was worthy of anything. Well, my grandfather stood up, clenched his fists. My grandfather was like 6'5", or almost, and turned every shade of red, was very upset because he didn't much care for New York. The people there had been kind of rude to him, because when they heard already by this time, if you told anyone you were from Dallas, you were immediately thought of as a relative of Lee Harvey Oswald, or you know what I mean? I mean, you're immediately thought of as a murderer, right? People in America thought that if you were from Dallas, that you were really a bad, terrible person.
You were personally responsible. So, yeah,
exactly. And he, so he and my dad had a rough time as it were there. Well, UPI had called my grandfather after Life did and said, we want to talk to you about buying the film. And my grandfather said, no, I have already told Time Life and they sent me a ticket and I can't, you know, underhand them, do anything underhanded with them when they're the ones doing all this. Well, after he got upset with Time Life for offering that and calling it a nuisance film, he went downstairs. He and my dad came back downstairs. They were ready to go back home to Texas. And there were the UPI guys there waiting for him. And so they went and looked at the film there, and UPI offered him, gave him $5,000, a handshake, said that they'd buy him a fedora hat. And they're the ones that took it, that bought the copyright to it. It wasn't what he expected, but it was more than what Time Life offered. And he didn't figure that, oh, well, it wasn't a waste of time totally coming to New York. And that was that. So he had told Time Life, don't ever use my name. I just don't want my name being used. I don't want a bunch of people coming around. And anyway, Time Life, UPI decided that they would have it analyzed, because by that time, there were already people like Joan Terrace and Sylvia Marr and Harold Weisberg, the first generation researchers, saying, wait a minute, there's no way that Lee Harvey Oswald did this on his own, and the Dallas police caught him within an hour and a half. Come on.
It just seemed a little too pat. A little too pat. Like, oh,
yeah.
It's just like, oh, we figured it out so quickly now, but we couldn't stop it. Now, here is a question for you. In terms of the differences of what he said he saw. Now, one of the things you mentioned, that it was shakier. The actual film when he got back was shakier. Now, if anybody knows anything about traditional film, it would be a small matter to actually reshoot the movie, particularly somebody like the government has all these resources, and create a second copy that was shakier. That would be relatively easy to do, even exactly. In that day, before digital effects and all of that. It would just be a physical thing. You probably make a copy of the copy. And you literally probably physically do some shaking. I'm guessing that's the way they would do it back then. But the other question is, what other differences? What exactly did he say was different between the film
he
gave
darker.
Up? Yeah, and it was darker too. Okay.
Right.
So and shakier and darker.
You know, this is what's shakier and darker. And you know what's odd, Mr. Harold? You know what's odd? Because he used the wrong film. I've talked to Rolly Zavala, who... if you don't know who that is, that's a man who was an expert with Kodak, who spoke before the ARRB about the Zapruder film. I mean, knows everything there is to know about film from that time. And he told me, he said, Gail, your grandfather used indoor film. What that should do is bring in more light. It wouldn't be darker.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
It would bring
right.
in more light. Yeah. And he said that the film is dark in those areas is circumspect. And it's true. So he used the wrong film. But using the wrong film should have given us more, let us able to see more, but you don't. You know, I mean,
right.
Everything in the background area is dark where it should be light, you know?
Right. Did your grandfather have any theories? Where did he feel that there was something that he saw?
Yes.
Something that he saw the first time around he didn't see the second time?
Not in regards to the film, but in regards to his experience being there. he believed till the day he died that there were more than three shots, that he heard four and he thought five. That's first what he thought, that the shots came from what he called the stockade fence area. That would be the picket fence area, not, I suppose, where badge man and all is. But I have to say this. I try to play devil's advocate all the time. If you go down the Dealey Plaza, it's much like New Orleans, and then it's like an upside down bowl because of the way that what do you call those things? I never remember what the structures there. They're circular. And they bounce acoustics off. I mean, it's strange the way, and with the trees and the buildings all there, right. it's just
an echo chamber.
Strange, like that sound of, yeah, it is. And so again, as a bratty teenage kid, I would say, Paul, are you sure? I mean, because it's kind of, it makes noises down there. I mean, you can hear, you know, and he said, I know what I heard. I know where I know that they came from. I was there. And, you know, you look at his film, and he's running towards farther away, but he's running towards the stockade fence area. I mean, he is. And there have been men over the years, and women too, over the years, that have done analysis after analysis after analysis of my grandfather's film on copies. I mean, which always leads to error because, I mean, it's not the original. You don't know if it's if what they're seeing is something wrong when it was being copied, or you know what I'm trying to say, Mr. Hill?
Yeah. They're not
so
looking at
important.
If it wasn't tampered with, then you would see the original and you know it wasn't tampered with, and you're analyzing.
Yes.
But you could be analyzing a copy that's been altered in 57 different ways.
It had a speck of dust in it.
Exactly.
It had a speck of dust when it was being copied. And that's why it's so important to find the original.
Do you believe it still exists? Do you believe the original still
exists? I do,
exists?
But I'm an idealist. I'm a Pollyanna. Most everyone says, no, you're never going to find that film. You're never going to find it. They've done it. Now, I will tell you this. In the late 90s, my dad sold the copyright to the 6-4 Museum, donated it or whatever. And one of the clauses in the contract we had with them was, if the original is ever found, I mean, it comes back to our family.
Right.
Well, Gary Mack, who has since passed away, had a copy that I had gotten from the FBI in 91. I had gone to the Dallas FBI office and said, look, here's my copy of the Nix film. And it's a first generation. But my dad has played it to all of our history classes over the years while we were in school. And it's really had it. I mean, it's really, really had it. Would you mind changing it? You have this one and give me the one you have. I mean, because at that time, I mean, you know, I didn't know first off that the original was missing at that time. I still didn't know. And they said, sure. And so I got their copy. And when my dad gave everything to the 6-4 Museum, Gary took that FBI copy and had it enhanced in 94, I think it might have been 95. Well, for the Lost Bullet, that show he did for the Discovery Channel. Anyway, to make a really long story short, he sent me a copy of it year before last, first I had ever seen of it, a copy of the FBI film that he had enhanced. And you know what, Mr. Hill, do you know what? There is a splice right after the assassination sequence in that film.
Oh,
how do you splice an original? You don't splice an original. And he swore to me, he's a Gale. I don't know how it happened, but I assure you that the portion on the second part of the film is original to your grandfather's film, to your grandfather's camera. I said, what do you mean? And he said the sequence where he came the next day, where he filmed the football game, that's all original footage. And I said, wait, so you're telling me that the assassination sequence is a copy, but it's spliced to the original? Who did that? And how did that happen? And why did it happen? So there you go. That's what I have found since I've written the book. Since I've written the book, that's what I have found. And I'm, it's just, It's, I don't know why everybody and their brother who doesn't know about this story and finds out about this story isn't up in arms about it like I am. I mean, I am because it's a personal thing. You know what I mean? Right. It's my grandfather's film. And I know he was there for a reason. But it's also, I'm up there upset about it because we're talking about the future of our children and our children's children. If we're going to lie about these kind of things, what else are we going to lie about? Or what else are we going to be lied to about? You know? Let's just be honest. I mean, the government needs to be honest with us and say, okay, we did this, we did that. Instead of people like me or Jefferson Morley or Harold Weisberg, who has since passed away, or, I mean, having to go through and find truth and throw it in their face and watch them still deny it. It's not right. You know,
now 50 years plus.
Exactly.
Why in the world would this be covered up if there's nothing to see? I mean, that's what I don't understand. What are your thoughts on
that? Me either. I think, I mean, here's the pat answer they give, is that it's for national security. Well, how could it be for national security? It was a president that was killed. It wasn't a foreign dignitary in our, you know what I mean, in our country. It was our own president. So how is that a matter of national security? Yeah, you know?
Yeah, it's almost like saying something from, you know, the First World War is a matter of the... I mean, it's that far back. I mean, the Soviets no longer exist, although we've got our problems with the Russians now.
Right.
You know, but the Soviet Union is a country which was our primary enemy, I guess you could say at that time, does not exist. I mean, basically all of the leadership of the time has passed away. I can't think of a major leader who was in their prime at that particular time that's even still with us. And that's one of the scary things, and I'll lead to this. You know, a lot of times when you're commenting about various people, you add the phrase, they've since passed away. And I think that's one of the tough things about this case, because every year that goes by, we lose more people that have a direct connection. We're there. We're part of the investigation.
And Mr. Harold, that is why I have been writing the book I'm writing right now that I told you this morning. I was like, I just forgot because I was like, there are still, luckily for us, a few people who were there that were on the periphery of the assassination. One is Father McCann, who is inherent to the Sylvia Odio story. One is Larry Schmidt, who was one of the men who put the Welcome Mr. Kennedy ad in the newspaper. Bernie Weissman, who worked along with him. And all of these people I've been interviewing for the last 2 years for this new book, and I've been talking to them about what they know or didn't know, or what they know has happened, you know? It's important that we get their names down and we get their words down to what they know.
Oh, yeah. No, I'd love to have you back on to talk about this one. I want to ask you this question. Your grandfather, you know, and there have been some really interesting books done on this, particularly Richard Belzer did a book called Hit List about all of the people who passed away after the Kennedy assassination who had some link to it. They were witness to something or something, and they all died under these mysterious, and I don't remember how many, I mean, it was tens of people. It was a bunch of people, and he went through the case of each one. Fascinating book. If you're interested in the JFK assassination, everybody, get that book, along with this one, of course. But my point is this. If you believe in the conspiracy, a lot of people believe that maybe some people were silenced, okay? Did your grandfather at any time ever feel threatened or in fear of his life? Okay, tell us about that.
Yes. I can just do it anecdotally. The best, I believe. I know he didn't want to scare us. My sister, my brother, and I would spend every other weekend just about, because my parents were quite young. I mean, they got married like most people did in the 50s at a young age, and so they were still young enough wanting to go places. And you know, even though they had three kids, and so on the weekends we would spend the weekends with my grandparents. And one of the things, my grandfather was very, very techno, I suppose. And when I say techno, everybody's going to laugh because to him, I mean, having a telephone, you know, in two rooms was techno. Having a television was techno. Having this camera that I was telling you about, this Keystone with a grip on it, that was techno to him. Not like what we look at now with all the, but for back then. Well, one of the things he always had us do was answer. If the phone rang, we were to answer it by the first ring. We were not supposed to let it go to the second. Because that to him, that was rude. I mean, you know, we should answer the phone. But after the film was, after the assassination, he had gotten a few phone calls with people saying, you know, you were part of this. You need to shut your mouth. You need to do this. And you know, he would go, what are you talking about? And they would hang up. And he got enough of those phone calls. And I'm not saying there were hundreds of them. Not at all. I'm saying there was 4 to 5 or 6 phone calls along those lines. And as far as I'm concerned, that could have just been the crazy type people that every one of us live with every day, every generation. But it was enough to scare him and my grandmother, too. And in fact, my grandmother did not want him doing any more interviews. I mean, because she was scared that that was what was leading to all of this. And he did an interview with Mark Lane, and in fact, he's in Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment film. And then he did one in 67 with CBS that put an end to all of it. I mean, because of the way they treated him. But yes, he remembers seeing people around his front porch, and he would go and check it, and they weren't there. And those kind of things. But as far as anyone saying, I'm going to kill you if you talk again, no. It was more like the kind of things like, you need to be quiet and you're not helping things and you were probably a part of all this and that kind of stuff. You see what I'm saying? And my grandmother had also read those stories about people dying. And in fact, Penn Jones, who was the first to bring that up before Mr. Belzer and before all these other, you know, he was a friend of my grandfather's and had come to talk to my grandfather many times, as had Wes Wise, who ended up being the mayor for Dallas afterwards. But that was enough to scare my grandmother and say, okay, well, no more talking about the assassination. You know, we don't know who's going to come after us. Yeah. You know, because of all of it, because it is really hard to explain to people who weren't living in Dallas at that time and weren't aware of just, it was permeable. The hate, I mean, from people, like I said before, from other states, but people were even distrusting of each other within the city at that time. And if you take into account the extremism in Dallas at the time, I mean, you had the Walker and the General, right, and the John Birch Society and the Klan and the White Council. And then on the other hand, you had, you know, the more liberal and the people who, of Dallas, the Dallas leaders who just wanted to put this underneath the rug. They just thought, well, if we don't talk about it, then people will quit assimilating it with Dallas. Of course, that didn't work and still doesn't after all these years.
Am I correct,
you know?
Lady Bird, who said to Kennedy right before he was shot,
Nellie Connelly.
Yeah, Mr. President, you can't say Dallas doesn't love you, right?
Doesn't love you. That was Nellie Connelly. That's right.
Yeah, that's right, because Johnson was in a different limo, interestingly enough.
It is. I would like to say this though about Johnson that a lot of people forget, and I'll be honest, he wasn't one of my favorite presidents. And he was from Texas. The stories we know about him and grew up with, knowing the things that Johnson did here in Texas, if the rest of the world had known, I don't think that he would have ever been elected anything. But anyway, Johnson, before Adlai Stevenson came and was assaulted here, you know, which wasn't a month before President Kennedy came.
Right.
Johnson was too. Johnson and Lady Bird, they were assaulted as well. Not spit upon and spat upon and had placards thrown at them, but there were protests against them when they came to Dallas too. So I just thought I would throw that in there. Most people aren't aware, kind of look over that too. Everybody was tired of the politics. Kind of, I see such a parallel to what's going on now, and the 60s. I'm sure other people do, but I see such a parallel to the politics of the time. You know,
yeah, it does feel does feel like we're in a very tumultuous time,
and
very much compare it to the 60s in many ways. That's a good analogy. Well, we really appreciate you coming on the program today. Tell us where people can find this book and find more information about all your work, and eventually plug into this next book you're coming out with.
Oh, and please, Mr. Harrell, everybody say their prayers and send good thoughts my way that I freaking hurry up and get this done. It's about... I keep finding new information. I go, I just need to get it done. But thanks for asking that. You can find it on Amazon. You can, and it's in hardback, it's in paperback, and it's on Audible. So if you'd rather hear it, and it's not my voice, thank God. People are like, oh, please, it's not going to be her talking, is it? No. It's another person's voice on Audible. But I also have a website. It's GailNixJackson.com, and I have been remiss. I haven't written much on it lately because I've been trying to get this book finished, but it will tell you where I'll be speaking or when this new book is coming out. And it does give background into the new book and tells you more about my grandfather as well, too, and the whole story. I mean, and I try to keep it interesting so that people will say, wait, I didn't know that, or, oh, I'd never heard that. Because I tell you, we've spent a lot of time on New Orleans. I mean, the JFK research community and the people who are JFK scholars studying New Orleans and studying Mexico. But you know what? There are still plenty of stories in Dallas, plenty. And they're very interesting. They're very, very interesting. And you wonder how much of it was contributable to the assassination. In my opinion, I wouldn't be writing this book. There was a lot more to it than what we know. Even I believe that there was a military industrial complex that was part of all this. But was it just the American military, or was it some upset Cuban ex-military? I mean, you know, we need to
the Bay
kind
of pigs,
look at all of it.
The Bay of Pigs and all of that.
Yes.
Well, our guest today has been Gail Nix Jackson. The book is The Missing JFK Assassination Film, The Mystery Surrounding the Orville Nix Home Movie of November 22nd, 1963. Gail, thank you for joining us today.
And thank you so much for having me, Mr. Hill. I look forward to talking to you again.
And thank you for tuning into The Conspiracy Corner. And as always, be careful when you're going around the next corner. There just may be a conspiracy. We'll talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.